Netflix.
Netflix is huge. My son picked it. My son picked it 2 years ago. I was 65.
Yeah, you mean that as an investment?
Welcome. Have a seat. There. Make yourselves comfortable. Thanks for being flexible with your time. We're running a little bit late.
That's part of it.
With regard to the materials you provided, they were marked confidential.
Yeah,
this is obviously
that
a public
was not intention, and clearly this complied with open meeting rules and shouldn't have been there. Sorry about that.
Not a problem.
So I'm George Sigular, and we're back here for the second time in front of your group, but we've had a lot of interaction with the staff here over the last couple of years, and we're going to be talking about an investment you have in our distressed real estate fund and the first fund, and some of the examples of the things we've done with it, and also introducing the fact that our second fund is now getting launched, and we'll continue to do same activities. For those of you who may not recall, Sigular Guff is a private equity firm that manages about $10 billion in various forms of private equity, staff of about 135 people, headquartered in New York. We have offices in Boston. We also have operations outside the U.S. In emerging market cities. Our real estate activity started in the early 1990s when there was the last large distressed real estate opportunity. Remember the good old days of the RTC and the S&L crisis. We were large participants in investing in real estate back in those days. The markets recovered, the economy was strong, and really it took the global financial crisis to put us back in the situation where we've had opportunities in similar valuations and such that we saw in the early 90s, starting in the late 2008-2009 timeframe. And that's when we began the work of putting together a distressed opportunity pool of capital. You invested in our first fund, which was $630 million. It had its final close in December of 2011. By December of 2012, the J-curve had been crossed. There was no ramp up in terms of rates of return. And now we sit here with the fund fully committed and 60-some percent drawn. So our target was to get money working quickly, and that's what we've succeeded in doing. We're well diversified across asset types, across geographically here in the U.S., as well as a first couple investments in Europe. The opportunities continue to persist, and I think it's up to us today to show you examples of what we have done, why the market continues to be available, and what we're looking forward over the next couple of years. So with that, I'll turn it over to Jim Coral, again, who I think most of you have met in the past, who heads up the real estate activities. My experience in real estate goes back almost 40 years. I did a number of investing things. I was one of the key people at Harvard's endowment investment operation. I also financed a lot of the university's construction, not only for dormitories and housing, but we did peripheral things in low-income housing and such around the campus, and that was my responsibility. Jim Coral was the chief investment officer at Cohen & Steers for 11 years, the largest real estate investment trust manager in the country. Left there at the top of the market in 2007 and said that was why he was leaving it. And we began our discussion shortly after that about joining our firm and building a team. Tony Carriggio has a longstanding real estate background, really got his start building things for the Air Force as an Air Force officer around bases around the world. Got his master's degree at Wharton in real estate, was with Morgan Stanley for a period of time, and then chief financial officer at St. Joe's, which was a large Florida development company. Nez Wygant came to us by way of Citibank, where he was a senior member of their team doing investments in real estate funds. And across the firm, we have support levels in all staff functions of accounting and legal and the like, taxes, but also a distressed team that functions in other kinds of distressed activities of another six or seven professionals. So with that, I'll turn it over to Jim.
All righty. Well, thanks. Thanks for having us back again and considering us again. 2 years ago, I think you all made a great decision to invest at a very opportune moment in the real estate cycle, and we continue to talk about how important timing is, and we believe you're going to start seeing the tremendous early sort of financial benefits of that decision very soon. We're going to show at least one example of that today. And during our visits here, we've shown you Many of the deals we've done, essentially, you know, with a recurring theme, which is buying great real estate at a fraction of replacement cost and using the right fraction of peak pricing and using a great manager to achieve that that uplift in value and turning that back into a piece of core real estate and doubling and tripling your equity in the process. We've shown you that in a number of different ways over the past couple of years. But what I want to do today is essentially talk to you about, you know, why the opportunity to do this is still out there in a big way. Again, to buy trophy real estate at half of peak pricing and use a little bit of local expertise and to double and triple your money. And the way I want to illustrate that is mostly by showing you deals that we've done very recently, things that we've literally closed within the last couple of months, the last couple of weeks, literally within the last few days, you know, to demonstrate that opportunity is really there today. And I'm actually going to talk to you about one prospective deal that will look very similar to one we did a couple years ago that I know some of you now are familiar with and have seen, and this is a deal that in all likelihood could be the first co-investment in a new fund too. So hopefully by showing you, you know, what's going on right now and a little bit about what the future looks like, you know, you'll be able to understand, you know, why that opportunity is still out there. First, I'm going to start on page 12 here and flip through a few slides, if you don't mind. I do want to leave you with a few quick comments about the state of the macro affairs in the commercial real estate markets today, just to give you a sense for why this opportunity is still out there today. You know, why the financial distress and the hangover from the excesses of the last cycle persists. And why these tremendous deals continue to be out there. And if you look at page 12, I mean, I think the single most important kind of macro dynamic to understand is you've got two lines there. One is essentially the index for core real estate. That's the green line. That represents about the top quartile of commercial real estate in the U.S., and you see that's rebounded very nicely. And the red line on page 12 represents kind of the entire market for commercial real estate in the U.S. And you see that, you know, since the bottom, those two, the top quartile versus the entire market, have behaved very, very differently. And we believe that's for one primary reason, which is that we've added up all the capital that has been put to work in commercial real estate, all the capital that's been raised over the last 4 years, and it turns out that 72% of it is focused on that top quartile, that 25% of real estate that sort of is categorized as core. And the other 28% of the capital is, the minority of capital out there is focused on kind of the everything else. And as Tony will talk to you about, you know, that's what we're looking for. We're looking for things that can easily be sold as core, but today are not currently looked at by the capital sources as core real estate. So that's the arbitrage opportunity in a nutshell. On page 13, you'll see, you know, this is the maturity schedule. You've seen this chart before. The area under this curve is our opportunity set, right? These are the volume of debt maturities. You can see here we are the peak year for debt maturities. Most of this debt was underwritten in the last cycle, and this is kind of the logjam of problems still facing the industry. We've got another 4 years after this year of $300 billion-plus of debt maturities, and in many cases, the real estate is worth about the same amount of the debt or less than the debt, so that's an upside down financial situation. That's the repository of opportunities that we're looking through. On page 15, which is our opportunity set looked at a little bit more micro fashion. You know, there are many silos of opportunity in real estate. We've kind of sketched out a number of them here on this list. You've got this timeline, and what this shows you is that different silos present opportunistic returns at different times. And what you'll see is the difference between Fund 1, DREOF 1, and Fund 2, DREOF 2, is that there will be some of the same silos that will attack for, you know, in Fund 2 that we attacked in Fund 1. There will be a couple of silos that will no longer be opportune to invest in for Fund 2, but then there will be a whole series of new silos that are just kind of opening up or have opened up very recently, which will be of interest for Fund 2. So you see Fund 2's opportunity set will be, you know, overall, I think it's likely that we'll have, you know, just as many, if not more, silos of opportunity that will be active and presenting opportunistic returns for in Fund 2 as we had in Fund 1. So on page 16, you can see what it boils down to for you, for Contra Costa, employees' retirement. You can see you made your $75 million commitment. That commitment is 100% committed to managers and to opportunities 15 months after the final close. So by March of this year, 15 months after the final close, we were committed. And there's no reason to think that Fund 2 will not be invested with the same urgency, with the same alacrity, given the tremendous deal flow that is that we've created through our relationships with all of these local sharpshooter managers for Fund 1. So in fact, Fund 2, and I think this is a very important concept for Fund 2. Fund 2 investor will step right into the deal flow that we've created with all these manager deal flow pipelines from Fund 1. You'll literally be stepping right into that. So, you know, lastly, on page 17, you know, just to review what we're talking about for Fund 2, a $750 million target, 60% into funds, 40% into joint venture co-investment type deals. We'll probably wind up in this with the same portfolio of 12 to 15 manager relationships. You know, of course, the documents say it'll take 3 years from the final close to get that invested with Fund 1. We did it in 15 months. There's no reason to think, like I said, we won't get that money out smartly and wisely, you know, into the deals that are just as attractive in Fund 2 in that same type of 15-month time frame. So let's move on to some actual examples of acquisitions to give you a sense for, you know, how immediate the opportunity set really is today. You know, you can see on page 19, you know, every one of these managers here listed on page 19 has generated co-investment opportunities for us that we've evaluated, and Fund 2, again, is going to step right into this deal flow that's proprietary to us in many instances, and is coming right off Fund 1. So Fund 2 is going to get right cracking on, you know, into that flow. What Tony's going to give you, he's going to start out by actually giving you one example of a very early co-invest. In fact, actually our first co-investment that we made that's now come full circle, right? That shows, that demonstrates the archetype of what we're doing, you know, with our managers, which is, you know, and shows you the tremendous uplift in value that can be had by taking a perfectly good piece of real estate that's in a distressed capital structure, applying the local knowledge of that manager, in this case, you know, popping a tenant into the asset, and then now on the back end, selling for, you know, once that cash flow is stabilized, selling for, you know, creating a multiple of your equity capital, and we're, you know, about to do that here. So without further ado, I'll turn it over to Tony to talk about a few examples here.
Hi, good afternoon. Page 20 lays out how the capital was deployed amongst all the managers. The first one I'd like to talk to you about on page 21 is with the manager that's about a quarter of the way down, called Weeks Robinson. They're an industrial warehouse specialist, really focused on the Southeast. We engaged them with $20 million into their fund, and we also set up a $40 million joint venture next to the fund to take advantage of investments that the other investors in that fund did not want to take advantage of. Specifically, going after brand new construction warehouses that were over-leveraged and in trouble at the height of the downturn. And so we've deployed that $40 million into those properties. The first example, as Jim mentioned, is here on page 21. It is a in-place constructed warehouse property and a piece of land adjacent to it that Bank of America had put a $25 million construction loan against. It defaulted. Bank of America took it back on balance sheet as REO. We bought it in August of 2011 for $19.2 million, a discount to what the loan amount was. By November of 2011, we had signed a 15-year lease with Restoration Hardware as a tenant to take the entire 600,000 square foot warehouse that you can see existing on page 24. They leased that existing warehouse, and then they engaged us to construct a second sister warehouse, brand new construction on that open pad. That is now completed. So page 26 shows you the finished product. So what we have here is an asset that was situated on the red line that Jim mentioned, is now fully leased for 15 years with a high credit tenant, throws off $4.5 million of cash flow a year currently, growing at 2%. We've now basically taken an asset purchase on that red line and moved it to where somebody on the green line will buy it, because it's now a yielding asset, and that's what we're going to show over and over again. That's the model. We, having done that, are going to market this asset in September for sale. And we had an unsolicited offer in May to buy this asset for $74 million. We've got $49 million into it, $17 million equity from this fund. We think it'll go between $78 and $80 million, so potentially $31 million of profit on a $17 million equity investment, you know, more than 2.5 times your multiple, approaching 3 in 2 years. And that joint venture that we set up with this manager is filled with this type of this type of execution, and we'll look to monetize all of the assets in that joint venture over the next year and a half. So that's an example of assets in a manager relationship we'd set up a couple of years ago, where we're moving assets from the red line to the green line. Page 27 is with a different manager, Crocker Partners. They're a Southeast office-focused manager. The asset you see on the page here is actually an office park that we purchased in suburban Jacksonville. You can see where it's located on page 28. You can get an aerial view of the park on page 29. Perfectly nice park, as you can see. This park had always been better leased than the market it's in. So all these assets that we're targeting are assets that have shown that they are assets that are in demand by the marketplace. Fully functional assets in a dysfunctional capital structure. That's the name of the game. Buy them away, fix the capital structure, lease them up, and sell them as leased properties. This one, Crocker had owned it previously, had sold it in 2005 for $152 a foot. We bought it in December for $40 a foot. Okay, the occupancy had dropped to 63% vacant. That's why we can buy it so cheaply. By the time we have it fully leased, we'll have it, you know, be $60 a foot. Previously sold for $152 a foot. If we sell it at $110 a foot in 5 years, we will have made a 21% unlevered IRR, more than 2 times cash flow. It's going to go faster than that. We've got leases out at market right now as we speak. And in May, again, we had an unsolicited offer. After having bought this in December, we had an offer by a party to buy the entire park for 20% more than we paid for it, which we did not take, because we can see what the power of what's about to occur here. And page 31 is another example of an asset that we acquired with Crocker, and this one we just closed. I mean, this is a May June transaction. You can see that this is a Class A trophy asset. It's located, as you can tell, on page 32 in Midtown Atlanta. Page 33 shows, you know, where it sits in the marketplace. Crocker had previously owned this asset. They sold it in 2005, when they sold the entire company. The owner that bought it basically over-levered it, got in trouble, and the debt basically at a point where it was going to default. We came in, we essentially constructed a purchase price here equal to the amount of debt currently on the property. So we bought it for $89 million, $178 a foot. That's half of replacement cost. A big discount to what was paid for it in 05. We extended the loan with the current lender by basically putting up a contract that says we will provide the equity to lease the building back up. When you do that, now we own it at $178 a foot. The building's recapitalized. Leasing brokers will show you the deals again, because you know that they know that you can pay their commission. You can pay the money to outfit the tenant space. We've already signed 35,000 square feet of leasing since we bought it a month ago. So I think these are examples of high-quality, fully functional properties that are on that red line that we showed you at the beginning, that clearly, when they get leased, will sell to the Green Line buyer, the yield-hungry market buyer, for a multiple on what we've invested, and that's what we've been doing for you in fund one. And as you can tell, these are recent transactions, very recent transactions. We've got a pipeline of these in front of us that fund two will step directly into. So with that,
go ahead, Terry.
I was going to say, on page 20, this is showing all of the different investments that you have, correct?
Yeah.
Any of them at this point not working out the way that you had hoped, or are all of them doing exactly what you wanted?
No, every manager is, and we of course, it's by design. They're very disciplined. They were selling assets at the top of the market, no 6, no 7. They've been able to be very opportunistic, and they're very value oriented. They've been putting their capital out at the right pace with the right discipline. And you know, I'm happy to say that you know everything we're doing here is performing sort of at or better than our original underwriting, which is, you know, the benchmark is that sort of 20% IRR, shooting for that 2x equity multiple, and there's nothing on here that is, you know, sort of underperforming or that we're worried about. It's all going very well.
So much of these investments they're held at cost from the marks you may have seen that you're getting. They're still held at cost because they're relatively recent acquisitions. And even that warehouse that we're about to sell for $75 to $80 million was marked at $67 million in the last quarter that you saw. So now we've had an unsolicited offer at $74. There's a lot of embedded value that's going to show up as we play this strategy out. And a lot of that value is on the buy. And those buys, those opportunities are still right there for us on Fund 2.
So you have properties in Fund 1 that the basic distressed capital structure is the buildings were leveraged at the apex of the market. Everything tanks, right? So all of these properties and opportunities become available, and they're now in a position where you can flip them. They reach fruition because you got them at incredibly low rates. Is the carryover, is the hangover from 06, 07
still there?
That extensive?
No, it's
there's no amount of a leave that got it from here to there.
It was an interesting cycle. Because there have been four times in my career you could buy real estate below replacement cost. We think back into each of the cycles and the distress in Texas and the like. This one was different. The last time around when we had it, the government really stepped in, funded $120 billion to basically prop up the savings and loans or put them out of business, took the properties directly into the government, and the RTC was selling this stuff. And it cleaned it up in about 3 years. This cycle, basically, the governing bodies of our banking system, the Federal Reserve, kind of looked the other way and let banks extend and pretend. Interest rates were very low, so the offsetting cost of just holding a non-performing loan was a lot less. And so the process has really stretched out much, much longer, as this recession has stretched out much, much longer. So we're still looking at these things, and you know the inventory of deals, the inventory of things we can do in this market set continues to be there in most categories. Now, some things that were really opportunistic 2 years ago, you know, people thought the dumbest thing in the world to do would be to buy construction lots in Phoenix, Arizona. Phoenix, in the right locations, construction has come back, and those things that we were able to buy then are doubles and triples. That opportunity kind of has passed us by. On the other hand, there are sectors of the market in the U.S. and in particular in Europe that are just starting. And some of the European opportunities are absolutely unique and weren't there a year ago. And we're not talking Spain and Greece and Italy. We're talking, you know, Holland and Denmark and Germany, where you can go in today and on an unleveraged basis buy very high-quality real estate on a 12, 13, 14% yield. And obviously at some point be able to re-leverage them and sell them at much, much lower rates of return.
Well, that you're answering, I think, one of the questions I had. Are the newer opportunities tending to be outside the United States? I know they started a slide later.
Some are, some aren't. But the thing is, you know, some of these properties, it just takes an awful long time for them to actually hit the wall, right? And as George referred to, the lenders are complicit in this. They'll say, even though you know, you've got, say, an office building which has long-term leases in it, and you can look at it and say, well, you know, we know it's, you know, it was worth 100 at the peak, and you borrowed 80, and now it's worth 65, and we all know that. But even so, you know, the bank's going to say, well, just, you know, just keep paying the, you know, we know you're in technical default because the value of the building's worth less than the, you know, less than the loan, but just keep on paying because we don't really want to have to deal with that right now. But then all of a sudden you get to the the maturity date of the loan, or maybe because the borrower hasn't been putting money back into the building to pay leasing commissions, which are pretty critical. So instead of bringing tenants to your building, the brokers are taking them out. So either you get to a maturity point of the on the loan, or enough of the tenants leave that the cash flow deteriorates, and all of a sudden you can't keep up the charade anymore, and it's 2013 or it's 2014, or it defaults in 2012 and it goes into special servicing, and the special servicer collects fees for 2 years, and then in 2014 says, okay, now we're going to sort of push this off the back of the truck and we've got to dump it because we can't collect the fee off of it anymore. And that's literally the way things are happening. And so these structures, they take a long time. So we haven't seen a lot of retail until recently. We haven't seen a lot of suburban office until recently because, you know, in a lot of instances, it's just taken that long to hit the wall. And, you know, that's the page 13 is kind of the best illustration of that, that, you know, those debt maturities that we, you know, we show there in the illustration on page 13, they're literally peaking this year in 2013. And then, you know, for the next 4 years, they're, you know, $300 billion plus. And that is our inventory of opportunities because those debt pieces that are maturing this year and over the subsequent 4 years were underwritten, you know, those are 10-year piece underwritten in 04, matures in 14. You know, 7-year piece underwritten in, you know, early 08, you know, matures in 15. So that's where that inventory of stuff is coming from.
But and is the page 13 inventory, I didn't flip back to it because I was actually listening to you, is the page 13 inventory of balloons coming due, for lack of a better term?
Yes.
Domestic only, or is that international?
That is just domestic.
It's a U.S.
That's
so,
a U.S.
So back to my earlier question, between Fund 2 and Fund 1, is Fund 2 going to be more heavily invested in properties outside the United States?
Yeah. Okay, so the other area, big area of the world, which when we set out to do the strategy and we knew there was going to be financial distress, which would result in great deals in commercial real estate, was, of course, Western Europe, developed Europe. So that's why when we laid out the structure for Fund 1, we said we know that right now that the stress is localized in the U.S., but in a couple of years, it's going to start being realizable in Europe. And so we're going to allow ourselves, per the fund documents, to go non-U.S. about 25% of the fund. So that was our stated cap. We're now at the end of Fund 1, and we've done about 18% of Fund 1 has been done with our local joint venture partners in Europe. For Fund 2, what we're seeing is that there are lots of windows opening up in Europe, and I would say that, you know, that in all likelihood, Fund 2 will be, you know, you'll see a higher percentage of the best deals that we see out there will be coming from Europe. More and more of those European deals will compete effectively on a financial attractiveness basis with what we're seeing, continuing to see in the U.S. So that the right number for Fund 2 will probably be higher than 18. We still have a 25% cap on non-U.S. investments for Fund 2, as we had in Fund 1. Okay. So if we get down the line and we, a year from now, and we're investing and we say, well, you know what, the right number actually, about 30% or 35% of the very best deals we're seeing are coming from Europe, then we've decided, you know, then and only then will we come back to the fund's limited partners and say, hey, you know, we'll make the case at that point in time. We'll say, hey, look at these, you know, look at this preponderance of stuff we're seeing in Europe. It competes very favorably, I think, as you'll see, with what we've got in the U.S., and we think the right number in terms of a cap is 30% or maybe 35%. I wouldn't foresee, I don't think that right number will be higher than 35. I wouldn't anticipate coming back at a later date and asking for more than, to raise the cap more than 5 or 10 percentage points.
Okay, and then I don't want to dominate this, but last question. The overlap figure, the Fund 2 overlap, with Fund 1 in
right.
terms of the opportunities. What's that inventory?
Right, so the best illustration for that is probably page 17, and, oh, sorry, page 15 in this book. And, you know, kind of shows you, it's a timeline, and each one of those, as we call them, silos, different property types, different types of investments, each one has a bar next to it, which represents our view of the world, which says this is going to be the period of time, or has been the period of time, when you can pull an opportunistic return with the right manager, selecting carefully, out of this silo of opportunity. And you can see silos open, and then they close. And, you know, we only want to be there committing capital to that silo when the window's open for opportunistic returns. So you can see what we've captured in Fund 1. The Dreyoff 1 box there kind of represents the managers and the silos that we took advantage of for Fund 1. For Fund 2, the green box, this is what we anticipate. You can see there will be a significant amount of overlap. A lot of those same silos are still wide open, and we'll be prosecuting those in some cases with the same managers. We've got probably about 5 of the existing managers from Fund 1. We're pretty sure we're going to just groove right into with Fund 2 because their investment program is continuing to just generate, you know, great. But a lot of the managers will be new managers, and some of the silos that we're attacking will be new silos. So there'll be some continuity. There'll be some new opportunities as well.
Is the fact that there are that many overlap opportunities remaining a sign that at least the initial assessment of the opportunity might have been understated? That is, the recession is far worse than was thought at the time.
And stressed out. So some things were very obvious. When we first went out, undeveloped or uncompleted condo projects were sitting everywhere. And they were pretty attractive, and we bought some and were able to sell them pretty quickly in auction markets and the like and take a spread. The market soon realized that an unfinished condo project was really an apartment building. And apartments have come back faster than anything else because people are not homeowners the way they were and the like. So condos converted to higher-end apartments pretty quickly, and the opportunity disappeared. But for a while, we were able to buy a few incomplete projects with a manager, complete them, and sell them in auction-type molds or with staple financing. But it has sprung out. If you look at how the banks have behaved, the big banks out here, Wells Fargo and Bank America, like big lenders, they're back to profitability now. And so every quarter, profitability is realized, and we're going to dispense of some non-performing loans. And so they're running it through at a pace. But they never had that moment in time where they just cleaned house and moved it all out. And that was partly their own strategy and partly the way they were dealing with the regulators. So we still have this process dribbling out. At the same time, we've had the economies recover. And so the perception of real estate, particularly the very high end, the gateway cities, the San Franciscos, New Yorks, and such, properties got priced to have yields that are competing with treasuries. So people are looking at their very, and maybe as they should, I mean, I feel that interest rates have no choice but to go up. And so if you bought a really successful piece of real estate on a 4.5% or 5% rate of return, how's that going to look when long treasuries are no longer 3.5% but are at 5 or 6? That's where the market moved. The things that needed to work, the things that needed to be reworked, were trading at the discount rates that achieve our goals with modest leverage to the 20% return. And ours is really to participate in closing that gap. The one thing we've avoided completely is areas where we don't think real estate's going to recover. So you're not seeing us participate in distressed in Ohio or Pennsylvania or Indiana or Lord knows Michigan. It's really areas where we think that there'll be population growth and some economic vibrancy.
Thank you. I'm sorry.
Okay, so there were two other transactions, but maybe in the interest of time, I'll skip one and go to the very last one, which is actually a prospective transaction, and we'll start on page, we'll just pick up again on page 39. And the reason I think this one's interesting, on page 39, you'll see the photo of a deal that I know a couple of you in this room have seen through Brian Kasoy, who's the head of the Sterling Organization, who's a retail manager that we really like. And you can see this power center. We've talked to you before about how it was bought very cheaply and how there's just a gold mine of opportunity in terms of things that you can do with an unmanaged, with an undermanaged center. And I want to show you another one that is, in all likelihood, would be the first co-investment for Fund 2, which is pictured on the next page. Now, that's on page 40. Now, this you'll see, it kind of, from the aerial, looks very much like the Pompano City Center. It's in a very dense infill area. It's in a top five metropolitan area in the U.S. Unfortunately, because Brian is still trying to wrestle this to the ground, we've kind of redacted the parts which would actually tell you where this is. But it's a vibrant area. It's a top five metropolitan area. And the story here is that this asset was built in 1957. It's owned by a gentleman who's 85 years old, who's a second generation owner, and they have been taking every dollar they can out of it. They have not been putting $1, sort of back into it. So there's a tremendous opportunity here to take an asset that hasn't been touched. And let me just start by, there's opportunity here a number of different ways. You can see we put in the traffic counts, one on the left side there and one across the north. Now, the traffic count of 37,800 cars a day, I went to the map, to your local map and tried to find an intersection and a stretch of road that you would know of that would have approximately the same traffic flow. So you all have gotten off 680 North Main Street, by the Marriott, the area between the Walnut Creek Marriott and the set of office buildings there in the Walnut Creek BART. So that section of North Main Street does about 38,000 cars per day traffic count. And you can see that's a very built-up area. It's a very great place to have a store. You don't see a whole lot of vacant lots along that, the way you do right here. So you say, one of the first things you can roll in and do here is, as of right, put up, build new pads, build new retail on that street front. The second one, the second street front across the top, the traffic count's 29,600 cars a day, almost exactly the same as the stretch of Civic Drive. You all know where the Nordstrom is on top of the mall there, and the Civic Drive kind of passes the Nordstrom and goes up toward Ignacio Valley Road. So that stretch of Civic also gets how congested that can get, about 29,000 cars a day, and yet you can see it's completely devoid of kind of any sort of street front retail. I mean, you could line that thing with pads. Target came to this guy a few years ago and said, we're doing great business in our Target store. We'd like to expand by 30,000 square feet. He said, that means I'm going to have to put money back into the space and, build you an extra 30,000 square foot box, which is nothing, costs nothing. And this guy, he just said no, right? So,
excuse me for interrupting you.
Yeah, sure.
It makes me wonder where government was to say to this guy, I don't know if they generate sales tax there or property tax or something,
yes,
but somebody was asleep at the wheel
government
back where this is.
Yeah, we've seen this kind of landlord before. This is a very old school landlord, and they just like to squeeze cash flow out. They don't like to put any money back in. So they're all kind of below market rents. I mean, the anchor stores here are paying $2 and $3 a foot, but because they're old leases, and as they expire over the next few years, there's a huge ability to mark up rents. I mean, you see the Ross they signed just a couple years ago for $19 a square foot. The Lucky's is at $18 a square foot. But the Kohl's and the Penny's and the Targets are paying, $2 and $3 a square foot. So there's tremendous embedded rent growth. There's other expansion opportunities. There's just so much low-hanging fruit in this asset. There's also an embedded 8% yield on the cost. This is a type of deal. Now, part of this deal will go into the Sterling Fund, which we've talked to you about. But a big chunk of it, roughly half of this deal is going to be a co-invest opportunity. And because when we negotiated with Brian Kasoy, the Sterling manager, we said, when you have a co-invest, we want just about all that. We get 75% of that. So this deal essentially is going to flow to us, which means it's going to flow to Fund 2 because the Fund 1 is out of money. So this literally could be the first $15 or $20 million co-investment deal in Fund 2. And it's, will likely to happen over the next couple months. Anyway, just to give you a sense for, what's past is prologue, the stuff is still out there. Some really great stories.
We are kind of running on time here. I want to be sensitive to that. I mean, you saw the one before, the in Pompano, where it was an $80 million mortgage. We were able to buy it for $16 million and such. And I guess some of you have seen the site. Yeah. Anybody who's been to South Florida, you've driven by it. It's on Route 1, just not far from the ocean. But I don't really have to wrap up with Nazar.
Happy to. Maybe if we just flip quickly to page 42. We can just run through our pipeline. This is this kind of shows how we analyze the real estate investment manager universe and then drill down to the managers we ultimately select. So you see about 1,000 real estate fund managers globally, probably 400 of which are raising capital at any one time. Several, of course, are not maybe marketing a fund specifically, like our relationship with Crocker, where we have just a straight joint venture with them. And after we've done our own pre-screening of those managers in advance, that narrows down to about 330 that we've had initial formal meetings with. All those managers are groups who have an identifiable edge in their space. They're managers who are targeting silos that we want to go after, kind of on that page 15, one of those blue bar charts. Groups that have excellent track records and groups who feel have right-sized their fund and their investment period for their opportunity set. That's led down to 43 groups that we've done comprehensive due diligence on, detailed track record review, multiple site visits, looking at their assumptions on every underlying deal, operations, risk control assessments, et cetera, and then 15 that we ultimately invested with after fulsome review of their limited partnership agreement, et cetera. Page 43 will show you the current manager pipeline for Fund 2. All of these are opportunities that we see could close in the next 12 months. And as their windows, we want to target managers who are the best in their field, tremendous track records, and then five of whom, as you see with check marks on the left-hand side of page 43, that we've effectively been diligencing for one or two or 3 years as they are managers currently in our Fund 1. So that's the existing manager pipeline. And then if you flip to page 44 and 45, kind of a repeat of what we just looked at, but on the co-investment basis, very heavy deal flow from our existing underlying Fund 1 managers. This shows you how it's worked in Fund 1. We structure our relationships with our managers such that they are of course incentivized to show us their deal flow. We do see flow, as you see up on the right there, from other managers because of our reputation in the marketplace, our co-investment expertise, our ability to execute quickly. And then about half of those deals that we looked at kind of passed through our initial screens and underwriting checks. We fully underwrote a little more than 50, submitted offers on 37 different deals, and closed 21 transactions in Fund 1. So 15 underlying managers in Fund 1, 21 co-investments. There are 9 that currently sit on our pipeline. We've shared some of those with you, and those are windows that are now open for Sidrioff 2. And if you look at the current list of investment windows there, lastly on page 45, you can see this is really what we're talking about when we say that Fund 2 will really step right into the deal flow from Fund 1. In Fund 1, we were 96% committed 12 months after the final close, 103% committed as of Q1, 105% committed today as given this transaction that closed last week. And because of this opportunity set, you can see on the far right there, potential likelihood for Dreoff 2 co-investments. I think in addition to the Fund 2 manager pipeline you saw there on page 43, I think we see the pace of investments that we will likely to make will be even faster than
in. Let me make one final comment here, which is flipping back to page 43, you can see we've checked off 5 managers that we used, that we made fund investments in for Fund 1 that we're likely to use in Fund 2, very likely to use in Fund 2. I'd say in four of those 5 instances, we actually also have fee breaks and other sort of special goodies that we negotiated through our Fund 1 involvement, which will carry over into Fund 2's involvement. So the economy of scale thing, and that, you know, having those pipelines and those relationships set up from Fund 1 will inure to the benefit of the Fund 2 investor in a number of ways. Deal flow, but also pre-negotiated discounted management fees from 4 of those 5 managers.
So that's kind of our story. We're obviously quite enthusiastic about it. There's a lot of this cycle left to be done. There's probably more left to be done than been done so far. And we've not had to lower or alter target rates of return. I think that We appreciate you coming in when you did last time because the story was less developed, but we knew what we wanted to do. If you saw the other 20 pictures, you would be just as impressed as the ones you've seen, and the opportunity continues there. So I think, you know, the commitment to do this is there. It is important to us to have you commit to the next fund. We're going through that part of the cycle now where the re-ups from existing investors will be the launch of the next fund, and we're here and we're seeing others along the way, and knock on wood, so far nobody has said no. They haven't all got to yes yet, but they all have their processes. But by and large, both our investors and the consulting community are pretty satisfied with what we've shown to date. I think we've had a different approach to the business. I think that approach has driven a lot of the fees out of it. Fees at the manager level, fees at our level are lower than a typical opportunity fund. And the breadth of opportunities we can see by having this large network of managers is really kind of unique in the structuring of the industry. So thank you very much for having us here. Any further questions?
When's your closing?
We're going to have a closing, hopefully, at the end of October to get us launched and have
August.
August. $150 to $200 million should get the first thing done. We kind of need it because, frankly, the pipeline has not slowed down any, and so we'll be putting money to work.
And on the commitments you already have, are all of them in Fund 1 also?
Of new commitments are coming in to close, yeah, just Fund 1 people. And we've really been focusing on the Fund 1 people to get them to re-up and such. So, you know, obviously you were a significant component of that. There are others that are similar in size that we're just about as far along with, but I appreciate it.
Great.
So thank you very much.
Thank you.